A vote to impeach the President of the United States. As the hour approaches, the Texas delegation comes to terms with an historic vote. The latest coming up on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. How are Texas representatives voting on impeachment? The latest from Benjamin Wormand of the Houston Chronicle. Also, the NBA tries to score big in Mexico, though this won't be an easy layup, that's for sure. And countdown for the president's much-talked-about military space force. Almost ready for launch? Or still the stuff of science fiction? All those stories and a whole lot more as the Texas Standard gets started. Liftoff right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 17th day of December 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. For those just tuning into the news, in case you haven't heard, it's impeachment week. And although this is one of the most serious duties the U.S. House of Representatives can undertake, short of resolutions for military action, perhaps, there are signs that much of the country just isn't paying attention and hasn't been for some time. NPR reporting yesterday that neither in terms of support for Mr. Trump or impeachment, the needle's just not moving very much, with the country nearly evenly split on the question of whether Mr. Trump should be impeached. Given the changing dynamic of Texas politics, however, this might well leave Texas politicians in a somewhat precarious place. If Texas isn't the red state it once was, as the 2018 midterm certainly indicated, then on the question of impeachment, how hard or soft is support for the president in a state that one can no longer assume will back the presumptive Republican nominee for president? Watching all this unfold is Benjamin Wormand. He is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Ben, welcome back to the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
The mood in the U.S. House of Representatives in the hours before the vote, how would you characterize it?
It's pretty hectic, I would say. They're trying to cram through a lot of legislation right here, and impeachment is just a piece of it. So it's kind of crunch time in D.C. right now. They're passing spending bills and a major trade agreement and some other Democratic priorities that they're trying to get through right before leaving for the holidays. And impeachment just happens to be kind of part of that.
With holidays. So the shorthand for a lot of this has been Democrats are going to vote yes, or Republicans are going to vote no on the question of impeachment in the House. And yet there have been some Democrats from Texas who have been a little slow to say exactly what they would do. What are you now hearing?
It seems like everyone's probably going to stick to party lines. Two of the last remaining major question marks, Lizzie Fletcher from Houston and Colin Allred from the Dallas area, both came out in support of impeachment last week on Friday. They were kind of part of a first wave of moderate Democrats who are seen as vulnerable in 2020, who said that they would vote to impeach. Henry Cuellar from South Texas is kind of a big question mark that's left, but he's a Democrat and he's likely to vote for it, I would say. Some of the other potential question marks on this were Will Hurd, he's been somewhat critical of Trump and, you know, has said that he did see some things in this whole process that worried him, but he's been pretty clear he's going to vote against impeachment. He hasn't seen enough to warrant that.
Of course, we should point out for those who don't follow politics quite closely, Will Hurd is a Republican. He's considered to be a moderate, but he had a very tough reelection back in 2018, and he has announced that he's not going to seek another term there in the U.S. House of Representatives. But he was on one of the Sunday talk shows saying that he's not going to be breaking party lines either. He sort of seemed to suggest that it's possible both to say that he doesn't like what President Trump has done here and also not vote to impeach.
Yeah, that's basically exactly what he's saying. I think he's basically said he views it as setting a dangerous precedent. He's said he doesn't want impeachment to become weaponized. And he just doesn't think that what he's seen warrants an impeachment vote at this point.
You know, I expect this question to be something of an oxymoron, since you can't expect a surprise, I suppose. But you mentioned Henry Cuellar, and I wonder, since he hasn't made any sort of announcement, he represents a large part of South Texas. Is it possible that he would vote not to impeach?
Anything is possible. He's certainly one of the most moderate Democrats in the House. He has been known to side with Republicans in votes, but I would say on this, I would be very surprised if he did break party ranks. Although many of his moderate colleagues have made clear what they plan to do this week, and he hasn't. So who knows at this point? But he's fairly loyal to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has backed his reelection bid. He's facing a potentially difficult primary race, one of the first he's faced in a long time. So he's probably conscious of that as well.
Benjamin Werman is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest at TexasStandard.org. Benjamin, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
When Texas lawmakers forced Planned Parenthood out of its health program for low-income women, the state struggled to find health care providers to fill that service gap. That led to the rise of what are called crisis pregnancy centers. These are often facilities with religious affiliations. They claim to provide compassionate support for women with unplanned pregnancies, but the critics say actually exist to try to prevent women from accessing abortion services. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports that some of those centers in Texas are changing their approach somewhat.
One of these clinics is here in Austin, north of 183, right off of I-35. It's a one-story building in a mostly residential area. Inside, there are modern and bright furnishings, and not really anything that signals this is a Christian organization. No crosses, no religious artwork. Andy Schoonover, the CEO of this chain of clinics called The Source, says this is intentional.
So we are a faith-based organization, but we don't push our faith down anybody's throat. We'll ask you if we can pray for you, and if you say yes, then we will, and if you say no, then we won't.
Schoonover's vision is creating a chain of religious women's health clinics. These clinics used to be crisis pregnancy centers, which have been pretty controversial. For one, these centers have been known to present themselves as healthcare clinics for women who are pregnant, but instead don't provide any real medical care. Schoonover shows me around the Source's clinic in Austin. He says this clinic was built to provide actual healthcare.
Our nurse manager is here. We're doing full medical, everything from STI, STD testing, well woman care. So you have your annual checkups. You can get contraception here.
The state of Texas has increasingly been relying on religious groups and new providers to deliver family planning services in the state after kicking longtime providers like Planned Parenthood out of their program. And women's health advocates say this shift hasn't been going well. For example, one Christian anti-abortion company called the Heidi Group was part of the state's family planning program, but state officials found they weren't providing the services they were contracted to provide. So Texas health officials kicked them out of the program and forced Heidi Group to repay $1.5 million. Cami Joffrey, the CEO of the Women's Health and Family Planning Association of Texas, says untested providers shouldn't be used in these kind of programs in the first place.
If we are funding unqualified healthcare providers in Texas, we are taking money away from qualified comprehensive healthcare providers.
But state and federal officials have been forcing longtime providers like Planned Parenthood out of family planning programs. This has left a huge need in a state like Texas, which was already struggling to provide contraception and screening services to low-income women. Schoonover says he thinks a group like his can actually fill that need, though.
We do substantially everything that Planned Parenthood does. The only thing we don't do is abortion, right? And you can go on Google and figure out where to do that.
There is another way in which The Source is not like Planned Parenthood, though. The clinics don't plan on offering the full spectrum of contraception. Specifically, they don't plan on offering IUDs, which are the most effective method of birth control. Schoonover says this decision is based on his religious belief that IUDs harm human life by not allowing a fertilized egg to attach to the uterus.
I believe that sperm and egg come together, it's a new human life, and so we want to protect that life. And so IUDs is not something that we'll do, but pretty much everything else we will do.
This is a common belief, by the way, among anti-abortion organizations. But Cami Joffrey says it's an example of why she has concerns about groups like this providing health care.
It's important that providers leave their bias at the exam room door and that clients work together with providers to leave that exam room with everything they need in that visit.
She says that's because in many instances, this is the only time many of these women will see a medical provider that year.
And if they leave without the contraceptive care that they need and want, they may experience an unintended pregnancy because they were not seen and heard by the provider that day.
Joffrey's biggest concern is that groups like The Source will eventually start getting federal funding that could be going to more established and comprehensive clinics. And for now, Andy Schoonover says The Source is mostly funded by private donations. He plans on opening another 20 faith-based clinics in the next few years. Women will pay on a sliding scale or nothing at all, depending on their financial situation. And they will offer contraception, which, by the way, has earned Schoonover pushback from the religious community as well.
Yeah, there's a stigma there within the faith community. We take a much more pragmatic approach on it, which is, hey, listen, you have two opportunities here. You can send them away without any contraception. They'll probably get pregnant again. They'll probably have an abortion. Is that a good thing, right? Or can we send them away with contraception and they are more than likely not going to get pregnant?
Schoonover says, regardless of where the pushback is coming from, he's going to continue to do this work because he thinks it's the right thing to do. In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez for the Texas Standard.
Joining us in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are Texans talking about on this Tuesday, Wells?
Hi, David. Austin's controversial rules regarding homelessness could see more change after the Supreme Court let stand a ruling that bans on camping in public are unconstitutional. The capital city's homelessness ordinances became a political lightning rod after Austin ended its bans on sleeping and camping in public, and Governor Greg Abbott threatened state intervention in response. The city reinstated some restrictions, but this new ruling might prompt lawsuits, as the Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to a ruling that found a ban against public camping in Boise, Idaho was unconstitutional. So that's a decision with implications across the country and across Texas. Mm-hmm. On our Facebook page, Jen Wireman says, this is the right decision. These people do not have anywhere to go. If you don't want them camping where you're bothered to see them, then support Housing First initiatives. However, Jordan Peterson is disappointed. He says it's time to take back control before we totally California our cities. Cities are for the common good. Public camping and its downsides are not. Just a couple reactions there on a thread that's generating a whole lot of conversation
on
our Facebook.
You know, this probably isn't going to be the last we're going to hear about this either, because if there's a split in the circuits, of course, because this is a Ninth Circuit opinion, we might see the Supreme Court take this up nonetheless. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Howdy, y'all. It's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When it comes to high-tech innovation, what cities come to mind? About 3 years ago, officials in Houston decided they wanted their city to be more competitive in that regard. And one thing they did, they started up an innovation district in Midtown, reviving and upgrading an old Sears store. But as Houston Public Media's Florian Martin tells us, some of the people who live in that area were worried about what could get lost in the race to attract tech dollars.
It's been named the ION, and it's meant to serve as a connection point for startups and entrepreneurs, along with resources, investors, and large corporations. It'll be part of a 4-mile innovation corridor that runs roughly along Main Street from downtown to the medical center. Carl Davis is with Houston Society for Change.
It will push African Americans out of community that they have invested in for years.
Houston Society for Change is one of four groups that founded the Houston Coalition for Equitable Development Without Displacement. They've held community meetings with stakeholders to voice their concerns.
We're also looking at the opportunities that the ION bring, job opportunities, for people of color, affordable housing for people of color, those services that we need to sustain ourselves.
Davis says they want the developer of the Ion Rice Management Company to sign a community benefits agreement. It's asking for affordable housing to be developed, support of minority-owned businesses, hiring of minorities for the construction, and inclusion of entrepreneurs from the community at the Ion.
If we're a community that they're sitting next to and will be affected by that, why don't we at the table enjoy some of those benefits?
Ryan Lavasser is a managing director at Rice Management Company. He says he's talked with Davis and others about the issue and that he's open for a dialogue.
We're going to look into different practices for hiring and different policies, and we want to best understand what it is the community wants, and we want to find the right people that can execute on this work.
Gabby Rowe, the executive director of the Ion, says she is concerned with making sure minorities and members of the surrounding community will benefit from the Innovation District.
What do we need to have in terms of programming to make sure that the small businesses in the community, the young people coming up in school and out of school, have the skills necessary to be able to take advantage of those innovation opportunities?
When it comes to affordable housing in Midtown and Third Ward, the city's housing department says they've been working on it. Ray Miller is assistant director there. He says there are already two affordable housing complexes right by the future Ion development, and he says the housing department is using a $350 million federal grant for Hurricane Harvey recovery for affordable housing.
And so the initiative of the city is to take some of the public dollars that we have to help offset those rising costs and the rising trends and place affordable housing options in those areas that we're seeing gentrification and seeing other households getting pushed out because of the rising rents.
The other part of it is businesses in the area, some of which may have to eventually make way for the development. Besides a Shipley's and a Jack in the Box, a daycare center is on Rice property and included in the Innovation District Master Plan. Some business owners in the area welcome the development. Spot Clark owns a barbershop just north of the future Ion.
And I think it's going to attract some great people to this area that would enjoy the services that we offer here at the barbershop.
But Carl Davis is concerned with the ripple effect gentrification could bring to the broader community. He says he'd be more confident in the future only when the developers of the Ion sign that community benefits agreement. In Houston, I'm Florian Martin for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Last week, the Dallas Mavericks beat the Detroit Pistons 122-111, and the San Antonio Spurs beat the Phoenix Suns 121-119. Yeah, I hear you. On the face of it, neither of those games seems hardly newsworthy. But these, in fact, made history. You see, both were away games, in Mexico City, to be precise. The former distinguished itself as the first NBA game with a statistical triple-double on Mexican soil. The latter was the first NBA game decided in overtime in Mexico. Both happened in front of sold-out crowds, more than 20,000 fans. But here's the real news. In the wake of these games, the league announced that the NBA is putting down roots in Mexico City. Los Capitanes will join the NBA starting next season. Yes, there is an asterisk here, but the announcement signals the start of something big nonetheless. Luis Miguel Vasavilbaso is a sports reporter for ESPN Mexico. Luis, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. I really appreciate the opportunity, and we still are excited about all the opportunity we had with the NBA, as you just said, about the G League, but also about the performance of Luka Doncic. It was mind-blowing for us.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about Los Capitanes. Now, you mentioned the G League. So the G League, as I understand it, is a sort of a minor league, I suppose you could say, in the National Basketball Association, a development league?
Yeah, exactly. It's a development league. And even though the NBA has an academy down here in Mexico that opened just a couple years ago, it's a pretty big deal for us because it's the first opportunity that we have that an American league pays real attention to Mexican sports.
How are Mexican basketball fans reacting to this news?
Of course, people would love to have the NBA team, but a G League is an amazing opportunity. People will have sellout crowds every single night because Capitanes is based in an area that is very close. You know, it's not so far the arena. It's like in a point that it's access very easily for the people. And even though it just holds like around 5,000 people, mm-hmm. Capitan, it's a project that has like 3 years. It was raised in 2017. So it's beginning to create a pretty nice fan base.
Something that a lot of basketball fans may not realize, the first NBA game was actually played in Canada. It was a Toronto team that actually hosted the New York Knickerbockers back in the late 40s. That's widely considered the first NBA game. So it's not like you can't have a team from another country be a part of the NBA. How long do you think it'll take before we'll actually see the first mainline NBA team in Mexico?
Well, I would love to say yes, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No? You know,
I think there's a lot of things that wouldn't allow to have an ABA team. And we had to be true. The economy of the country makes it really hard, you know, because even though we have the fifth sellout, a straight sellout in this year, it's not the same to have it, to have just like two games a year and compare it with having three games a week. You know, mm-hmm. and that's an important thing. And even though they can, sponsors could help a lot, and there's a lot of interest about this, the economy, I don't see it working with the people, like, because it's expensive tickets, you know, and NBA G League team, it's more or less around the prices that people is used to pay here.
Boy, that's really interesting. Well, fingers crossed. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, we will be watching very eagerly to see how things develop, because it does seem like something big is happening just south of our border. Luis Miguel Vasavilbaso is a sports reporter for ESPN Mexico, and he's based in Mexico City. Luis, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. It's been delightful.
I appreciate it, really, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Dallas-based Southwest Airlines is canceling thousands of additional flights due to ongoing problems with the Boeing 737 MAX jetliners. The company today pushed back until mid-April its plans to return the aircraft to service. The delay comes a day after Boeing announced a production freeze as it works to resolve issues that led to two deadly plane crashes. Dallas Morning News aviation reporter Kyle Arnold says Southwest and Fort Worth's American Airlines are relying on new planes to meet demand next year.
They do have a lot of planes on back order from Boeing, hundreds over the next couple of years at Southwest, and they're counting on these planes to fill their backlog next year when the FAA does certify this plane to fly again.
American Airlines last week also extended cancellations of its 737 MAX flights until early April. People in Texas and across the country have a new deadline to buy insurance through the online marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act. The enrollment period was extended until December 18th at 2 a.m. Central Time following issues with healthcare.gov on Sunday. Melissa McChesney is with the Center for Public Policy Priorities in Austin.
And that's always a good opportunity for our state when we have more opportunities for folks to get health coverage.
Texas has the nation's highest uninsured rate. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller will host a new national TV show starting next month. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports.
It's called Texas Agriculture Matters and will premiere January 21st of next year on RFD-TV, a channel that mainly focuses on rural issues. Using his experience as a rancher, farmer, and rodeo cowboy, Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller says his show will include a variety of topics.
Great things in Texas like cotton and cattle and hemp and horses and rodeo and you know, our tourism.
Miller says he'll host the show at RFD-TV, the Cowboy Channel studio in the Fort Worth Stockyards, but it'll also include interviews with people from all over the state. He adds he won't be compensated for his involvement. I'm Sasha Kortner in Houston.
Some Texas Democrats running for U.S. Senate are criticizing an endorsement for fellow candidate M.J. Haggar. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee announced Monday the Air Force veteran is their pick to challenge Republican Senator John Cornyn. David Sanchez is the campaign manager for Christina Sinzun Ramirez, one of the 12 Democrats in the primary race.
It was a little bit disheartening for us to get that endorsement this early on the campaign, where still more than half the voters haven't decided who they're voting for.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron Adler Clough and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. When President Trump first mentioned the creation of a space force last year, many people were surprised, quite a few a little more than skeptical. Well, now with bipartisan agreement from Congress, it looks as though there will be a Space Force, a new branch of the U.S. military. And what exactly would it be dedicated to? Here to help us understand how this Space Force came to be and what it is really expected to do, Oriana Pollack. She is the air warfare reporter for military.com. Oriana, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's discuss whether or not we're talking about a new branch altogether, or whether this would be something that might be attached to the Air Force, or what are you hearing?
So originally, the idea for what President Donald Trump wanted was an entirely new branch, a sixth military branch, which it's still monikered to be. But really, the Space Force is going to be nestled under the Department of the Air Force for the foreseeable future, much like the Navy oversees the Marine Corps.
Now, a lot of people associate the Space Force with President Trump. It's kind of interesting. There are a lot of people that are so excited about it, they put up T-shirts and the like on Amazon. I'm sure you've seen these things. The idea didn't actually originate with President Trump, however, right?
That's correct. It actually started in 2017 with Congressman Rogers from Alabama and Cooper from Tennessee. And what they had proposed at the time was something called a Space Corps, also that they wanted the Air Force to oversee. But they were kind of toying with the idea of it also being its own separate thing within the Pentagon. And so in 2017, they proposed this idea. They put it forth in some legislation, but ultimately it never made the language of the National Defense Authorization Act for that year. Mm-hmm. So what happened was is that President Trump got word of this idea of its of a new separate service or just some sort of separate group or entity that would oversee space communications and space, quote unquote, war fighting. So he had proposed the idea once again the following year and had told Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford at the time, to, quote, get it started. And it started up after that as a Pentagon initiative. And here we have it some months later.
So last week, the House of Representatives passed this Space Force proposal, and this looks like it's, all systems are go. But I think this kind of fires the imagination when it comes to what that space warfare you were just talking about means. What would a Space Force look like? What would space warfare look like?
Well, so we're seeing already from what U.S. military officials say is that, you know, China and Russia are already putting, quote unquote, certain types of weapons to hack our satellites and things like that in space. Mm-hmm. But what you're really going to get is something that, you know, protects those satellites and all the things that we put into orbit to protect it with some cyber hardening, some things that protect it from hacking, all these types of, you know, equipment, and even some new constellations of satellites, too, that help people right here, right on Earth, but also position ourselves well enough in the future that when we do progress and go to Mars and, you know, we have the moon landing coming up as well. It's all these things that help humans, you know, behave a certain way in orbit and, you know, into the galaxy. And that's exactly what they're trying to see. How is this going to morph into the future? But right now, it's to protect a lot of the things that we do right here on Earth.
I think that there has been a real reluctance, though, on the part of civilian governments going back to the earliest days pre-NASA, the militarization of space. Is this genuinely a sort of new frontier when it comes to how the U.S. Deals with that final frontier, as they say?
I think it's been an interesting wake-up call, especially for the U.S. military, because what the military wants people to understand here with the creation of a Space Force is that they are not NASA. They're not looking for space endeavors and science in space. This is really just that protection front. And the wake-up call that came was actually back in 2007 when I think China, it was, blasted one of its own satellites to see if they could execute such an operation. And it caused a ton of debris and things that went crashing one into another. And it created an awareness for the military that if they could do it to themselves this way, what could they do to us and the actions that we take in space? And so what they really want to do is, again, use it as a deterrent, have it be used as a protective measure. Again, maybe one day they will usher in a new frontier together, but at this time, that's not where it's headed.
So I mentioned the House of Representatives passed this Space Force proposal. What happens next? What's the next shoe to drop?
We're going to see the Senate take it up in a few weeks. Whether or not they do it before the holiday vacation is to be seen. But there is some pressure for the Senate to get it done because they know it's a big deal for the president and the White House, considering how much enthusiasm there has been for the new branch. So we will see the Senate take that up. And then afterwards, it heads to the White House for a final signature from the president, and a Space Force will be created.
Oriana Pollack covers Air Force operations and defense technology for military.com. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Oriana, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects.
Hibernating wasps. So this is actually a really cool thing. So when we're talking about hibernating wasps, the ones that I'm going to be referring to are paper wasps, hornets, and yellow jackets. These are going to overwinter in the adult stage, but it's only specific ones that overwinter. So it will be the mated females that will leave the nest in the fall and they will go and find a protected location, whether that's leaf litter or underneath tree bark or in a crack and crevice of somebody's house or an attic space or a wall void or whatever. They find someplace and they will spend the winter in that location. And then when it starts to warm up in the spring, those particular females will emerge out and they find a suitable nesting site. So if we're talking about a paper wasp, like under the eaves of a house or something like that, when we're talking about yellow jackets, that's usually some sort of a burrow in the ground or a hole in the ground that they'll start creating stuff in. And then hornets will make aerial nests. So that's gonna be like on a tree branch or something. All three of these are gonna make a nest out of chewed wood fiber. So it looks like a paper material. But the founding queen, she'll start to create a nest, and when she has some of the cells made, she'll lay eggs in them, and then she'll go out and start collecting food for them. And then once those pupate and then emerge as adults, those wasps are going to be the ones that will take over those duties of building the nest bigger and foraging for food for the larvae, and the queen will then transfer over to just laying eggs for the colony. And that will continue throughout the summer. And in the fall, the queen will transfer from laying female eggs, which are going to be the workers that are emerging out, into laying male and possible female eggs that can reproduce. So when those males and possible mating females emerge, they will mate, and then the males will die. And the females that are then mated will go off to find a place to overwinter again. And so they start the cycle all over again. So a lot of people will call in because they have wasps that have emerged, and they'll find them on their windowsill or something in the wintertime. And they're wondering why they have that activity right then. Usually when that occurs, it's because the wasps, those founding females, are overwintering in some crack or crevice in the house, and we have one of those sunny, warm winter days, and that kind of fools them into thinking, hey, spring is here, because they're not going by a monthly calendar. They are going by environmental cues. And so if we have a warm, sunny day and it hits them and they're good and all cozy, then it's like, hey, it's springtime, and so it's time for them to emerge. But then when they can't find any food, they end up dying.
I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist with the Texas A&M AgriLife Service. If you've got something bugging you, let us know on social media or shoot us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. Yes, it's that time of year when lots of us give ourselves permission to do a little more indulging. Oh, come on, admit it. The food is sweeter and fattier, and we just don't care as much because, hey, the holidays come but once a year, the winter ones anyway. But if you're a parent or perhaps a grandparent or aunt or uncle or something and will be hosting kids at your house in the coming weeks, you just might notice that even when you're not trying to indulge them, the options aren't often that healthy for kids, even when the packaging might suggest otherwise. Writer Bettina Elias Siegel is well known for her blog, The Lunch Tray. She's based in Houston and takes a deep dive in her new book, Kid Food, The Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World. Bettina, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me here.
You're a mom, right?
That's right. I'm a mom of two, although mine are pretty old now. I have a 17 and 19-year-old. So,
have things gotten easier or harder since your kids were really super young when it comes to trying to feed kids more healthy?
Well, I think it's a real challenge for parents right now to feed their children healthfully, even when they're trying to do their very best at home. A lot of the product labeling out there can be very confusing as they're trying to pick healthy foods for their family. They can get very misled.
Yeah, but, you know, let's throw this back on the kids a little bit, because I think a lot of parents will understand. I'm a parent. I got a couple of kids. Kids can be picky eaters. So what you gonna do?
Well, they sure can. And I do talk about that in my book, because I do think that that is one thread kind of underlying why children in America are not eating very well statistically. And one thing I do in the book is share all kinds of expert insight into what's going on in that early period when you are introducing solids and you have a toddler, because a lot of that behavior is actually normal and expected. And if parents can just kind of ride it out, they tend to do a better job of, you know, avoiding a lot of these feeding pitfalls. But the one thing I think parents really want to avoid is what we call short order cooking, where it's like, you know, mom and dad are going to have salmon and, you know, asparagus, but you're going to have chicken nuggets and mac and cheese. And when you do that sort of thing, you're really depriving your kids of the opportunity to learn and grow at the table.
Interesting thing here in Texas, it may be particularly difficult to feed your kids well because, well, we have things like a state law, like this so-called Safe Cupcake Amendment, which you write about. Could you explain what that is for people who can't believe that such a thing exists?
I sure can. This was signed into law by Rick Perry, and basically it guarantees the right of parents and grandparents to bring any kind of treat they want into school classrooms on their children's birthday. And what that means is, even if you have a very progressive school district that wants to do something like, hey, we only want cupcakes one day a month for all the kids who have a birthday that month, or we'd like you not to bring sweets, we'd like to celebrate with story hour, or, you know, some other way of honoring children's birthdays, they can't do it. The state law trumps the local attempt to change the policy.
Which I think points to something else here, this political aspect aspect of it. I mean, you take a look at what Sid Miller, the agriculture commissioner, has been doing here in Texas when he talks about getting rid of Michelle Obama's edicts for healthier eating at schools, that kind of thing.
It is so unfortunate that school food has become so politicized. And I think Michelle Obama's involvement during her husband's administration, while it was so wonderful from a food advocacy perspective, did, I think, have the effect of making it even more of a political hot potato.
I wonder, Bettina, if you have any special tips for parents or those hosting kids over the next few weeks.
I would tell parents, really, the holiday party or the Christmas dinner, that's not the time to be worrying so much about what your kids do and don't eat. Let everyone relax and enjoy those events, and then you can take the longer view at the dinner table.
Bettina Elias-Siegel is a Houston-based writer, known for her blog The Lunch Tray and her new book, Is Kid Food the Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World? Bettina, nice to talk with you. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The debate over gun rights and gun regulations took center stage in Washington earlier this month when the U.S. Supreme Court took up a rare case focused on the Second Amendment. In the run-up, gun control advocates expressed grave concerns that in taking the case, the justices appeared to be signaling a willingness to expand the Second Amendment. But the oral arguments wound up focusing on whether the justices should dismiss the case altogether. For Public Media's Guns in America project, Matt Richmond reports on what all this could mean for the debate over gun control.
Outside the Supreme Court on this cold December morning, a few dozen gun control supporters were holding a rally, while inside the court, the justices were preparing to hear a gun rights case. Tatiana Washington from Milwaukee was outside the court. Not long ago, a stray bullet came through the window of her parents' home.
Culture normalization, where it was like, haha, like, it was just like, kind of like all like laughed it off because this is like supposed to happen in communities like mine, even though it's not okay, it shouldn't happen, it's not supposed to happen. Like,
the case was New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City, a challenge of a New York City law severely restricting where firearms could be transported. Here's why every town for gun safety, Giffords and Brady, were sounding the alarm. An opinion from this solidly conservative court could be used to strike down other gun regulations and derail campaigns for new laws. That, according to Paul Brockman of the gun rights group Patriot Picket, is exactly what the court should do.
Absolutely not. This is a fundamental right. I mean, we don't restrict the 1A in New York more than we restrict it in Texas. Why should we be restricting the right to bear arms in other states than we do in the more freer states?
But it doesn't seem like the court will make that ruling this time around. Almost all of the one-hour hearing inside the court focused on whether there even was a case to consider, since New York City has already repealed the disputed law. Chris Brown, president of Brady, was at the court after the hearing and said that's a clue about what's coming.
It's impossible to fully predict, but yes, I would think that if they were more interested in the substance behind it, they would have gotten to those additional issues.
The court could dismiss the case as moot. That would give gun control advocates a chance to take a breath. But next year, those advocates will probably be back in the exact same place, says Ilya Shapiro of the Libertarian Cato Institute.
If this case is indeed mooted out, it's not the end of the world for those who want either broader Second Amendment rights or the court to start fleshing out the scope of it, because there are already a stack of petitions fully briefed and ready for the court to decide.
Next up could be a case on the stricter limits to carrying guns in public adopted by some states, or one on limits on gun magazine capacity. Gun rights groups and some of the conservative justices on the court have grown impatient in the last few years. The court established an individual right to own a firearm in the home in two big decisions almost a decade ago. But since what's known as the Heller case and the McDonald case, the court hasn't ruled on the Second Amendment. Chief Justice John Roberts is likely to be the swing vote in this sharply divided court. But Shapiro says that a vote to dismiss the New York case doesn't mean their cause is lost.
You know, mootness doctrine is separate than the merits. And John Roberts was part of the majorities in Heller and McDonald, so just because he would rule that way on mootness doesn't indicate anything on the merits.
For gun control advocates, the Supreme Court arguments gave them optimism about a dismissal in this case. And John Lowy, lead counsel for Brady, saw hope for future cases in an unlikely place. Justice Samuel Alito.
Justice Alito does have a background before he was on the court in law enforcement and in enforcing and, you know, prosecuting some of the sorts of laws that would be at issue.
Early in his career, Alito worked on criminal cases as an assistant district attorney. While Alito is seen as a solidly conservative justice, Lowy says he saw an opening in Alito's questions during the hearing.
Our view is that the Constitution allows laws that protect public safety broadly. You know, Alito was not disputing that. He was simply asking, is there a public safety interest in the law that's at issue?
If that's the standard the court adopts whenever it does tackle the Second Amendment, says Lowy, then gun regulations have a shot, even with this court. For Guns and America, I'm Matt Richman.
Guns in America and our partner station KERA are spending a couple of years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As Wells Dunbar sitting here in the studio. I see you have some paper there.
I have some paper.
Has some stuff on it having to do with what
I've printed out the internet on this piece of paper. I'm always amazed. Here I am bringing in a dead tree to talk about tweets and Facebook updates.
Yeah,
but what are you going to do? You know?
We could have a screen.
Yeah. I wonder what people think of as the Texas Standard Studios, because it's probably not quite as high tech as you'd imagine, although it's pretty cool in here. I dig it.
We've got four very large screens surrounding us, all kinds of buttons and things. That's not true.
The Starship Enterprise.
A bit
okay,
like
come on, let's get back on track. Yes. Well, let's talk about, you know, we were talking about impeachment at the top of the program, and of course, so are our friends and listeners on social media. Lots of reactions coming in here. Adam Kahanek, he says, how about the president testify along with all those who have been subpoenaed? Meanwhile, Joey Hossen,
he seems to think it could maybe cut both ways,
David. He says, I really hope that the president calls the Dems bluff and extends the trial to call the whistleblower to testify. Probably file there under things that may not happen
again,
as well.
Yeah, won't happen.
Patrick Quinn says he predicts if the Senate doesn't convict, it will turn blue in 2020. Interesting. Who knows how that one will shake out. Mm-hmm. And Colin Boyd says the Senate is too scared to have any trial and are attempting to do as little as they think they can get away with. So yeah, it will be fascinating to see what happens after that vote on Wednesday when the House punts it over to the Senate, and we'll see how they do indeed proceed.
Did you hear what John Cornyn, the Texas senator, was saying that they might do?
I did not.
They might actually take a rather than just dismissing the articles, which they could vote, they could actually have a vote to acquit.
Yeah.
And apparently, Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader there,
to
has
do
not
that, the
decided...
president gets to serve a third term.
Is that the way that works? wasn't sure what the Constitution had to
I've
say
seen
about
some
that.
Very spurious claims from self-described constitutional scholars on Twitter describing as such. But that's not the case.
It's going to be an interesting next few days.
You know, on a note of personal privilege here, you know, here at the Standard HQ, KUT, we're going to be having our holiday party here in just a few moments.
Yeah.
And so I decided to bring something to the table inspired by Twitter and quite a lot of reaction we got there.
Does it smell like cinnamon?
You know, it kind of, it's good. It's a very multifaceted flavor.
Right.
It's hot Dr. Pepper.
Mm.
You ever had a glass of hot Dr. Pepper?
I don't think I have.
You know, this was something that...
I left one in the back of the truck one time.
Yeah.
So
slightly different. You warm it up. You serve it with a lemon slice. You do a Google image search. You see all these old advertisements. This is definitely like a 50s, 60s era thing. Sort of a way to boost sales, I guess, in the winter months.
Yeah.
But it was actually Dr. David Brockman on Twitter. He was talking about this. I retweeted it. We had a conversation. Kind of blew up. So now lots of people chiming in with hot Dr. Pepper takes, whether or not they've had it, whether or not they like it. Taylor Barnett tweets, how have I never tried this? Someone else tweeted that they're going to call the police on me because I've kind of been live tweeting my warming of the Dr. Pepper in the crock pot. So I guess we'll fill you in tomorrow. Pot. Yeah,
how boy, the, you're doing this with style. DP. You're not just sticking it in the microwave.
Mm-mm, no, sir.
No. Hey, listen, we'd love to hear your special recipes for the holidays. Make sure you tweet us at Texas Standard. We're out of time for today, but we'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you'll join us.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.